Regular listeners will know that Stephen De Silva is a guide at St Albans Cathedral and was formerly a warden, one of the wardens. Stephen's been in a number of times now talking about different aspects of the cathedral and of local history. Stephen, you're going to tell us today who, bring up the bones, who's buried there?
Yes, we thought we would just look at a few of those characters who are part of our history.
And it starts, of course, with the man himself, Alban, because that's where he's buried?
Yes, absolutely. The whole purpose of the abbey was the burial place of St. Alban. So, you know, the early Christians always gathered around the graves of their martyrs as a place of worship. So that's exactly what happened in St. Alban's. Burial place of St. Alban becomes a place of pilgrimage, and then a church, and then an abbey, and indeed the great building we see today.
And it's not just Alban, but also Amphibolus, who was the man that converted Alban and that Alban then risked and lost his life for.
Amphibolus is a wandering Christian priest. He's actually nameless in the original version of the story, but later on he's given the name Amphibolus when people retold the story. Amphibolus means the cloaked one, so probably something to do with his secret, you know, mission to spread Christianity. But later on, the relics of Amphibolus were discovered at Redbourne. Traditionally, that's where he'd been martyred. And so they were brought back into the cathedral, and a new burial place was provided for Amphibolus as well. So really, the whole purpose of the building was the resting place of these two saints.
Now, Alban, therefore, was there first, as it were, and then the building was built around him, if you like, although they moved him. But Amphibolus was brought back. When was that?
It's sometime in the 1100s. The actual date varies according to different accounts, but he was rediscovered at Redbourne. The relics of Amphibolus, the bones, were brought down the Redbourne Road. And in a rather lovely gesture, the relics of St. Alban, the bones of St. Alban, were carried out, and they met each other on the road. Fantastic. And Alban accompanied them back to his new home, his new resting place. Okay. Rather lovely bit of kind of medieval ceremony there.
The tomb of St. Alban is actually very central to the cathedral. Well, not geographically central, but it's there and very visible. Amphibolus?
The Amphibolus one is kind of tucked away at the moment. Both of them were smashed up at the Reformation and only rediscovered. The pieces were rediscovered in the late 1880s. So they were pieced together. The Amphibolus one had been made of very soft Tottenham stone. So in fact, it suffered very badly from the reformers' hammers. The Alban one had been made of rather hard Purbeck marble. Mm-hmm. And so it was easy to piece together the Alban one. The fragments of the Amphibolus one have kind of languished in a dark corner for the last 100 years or so. And we currently have a project to restore them and clean them up and reposition them. Because he's an important person. You know, he's the person who brings Christianity to Britain, as far as we can see.
Okay, and do you see that being close to Alban's tomb?
It will be nearby. His original position, Amphibolus and Alban, they're actually in line with each other. But if we put Amphibolus back where he originally was, it would get in the way of, well, it would get in the way of brides coming in and out of the Lady Chapel for their wedding. So we've decided not to do that. We're going to position him adjacent to where he once rested. Right.
Coming forward then, I guess that there were a few people around in the medieval period.
Oh yes, I mean, there are lots of recorded burials. I mean, perhaps one of the most fascinating is a chap called John Mandeville, who may or may not ever have existed, but he was an adventurer of the 14th century. And a book was published about his adventures in foreign lands, and he was regarded as a great romantic hero. And there's actually an inscription in the abbey from the 17th century, which talks about, it's recorded in the 17th century, which talks about this being Mandeville's resting place, and his ashes rest in an urn nearby, you know, or rather romanticised. It's a lovely idea. He may be there, but then he may not have existed. So St. Albans makes claims sometimes for things, doesn't it?
There is, in fact, an inscription, isn't there? Something?
There is, yes. A high up painted, just as you come in the west end, the grand entrance to the abbey, if you look up to the left on one of the pillars, there's a painted inscription there, which is, if I just read a couple of lines of it, this is the translation. Check your step as you rush by. Mandeville is at rest. His humble urn is here. Even monuments know death, you know. Don't forget Mandeville as you go past.
Mandeville was when?
Mandeville, the book that's published under his name, is mid-1300s.
Okay.
So if we go forward another 100 years or so, maybe our most significant character, of course, is the only royal person buried in the abbey. The abbey was founded by Offa, who was a royal king, but Offa was never buried there. Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, brother of King Henry V. So Agincourt, all those wonderful romantic battles when Henry's off trying to unite the crowns of England and France. Humphrey, his brother, in effect is the ruler of England while Henry is away. Humphrey had a great devotion to St. Alban. Really loves St. Alban. Everyone else in that generation of the royal family, of course, buried at Westminster Abbey, around the tomb of Edward the Confessor. But Humphrey insisted on having a burial place prepared for himself right next to the shrine of St. Alban. And he prepared that in his lifetime. That was very common. People got their burial places ready. And he endowed a chantry chapel so that a mass could be said for his soul on a regular basis. And he was given a very particular honour. He was given the only private crypt in the whole building. So he's actually buried down under the floor in a crypt chapel. And if you go and stand in the shrine, you can look down through the grate and you can still see Humphrey's coffin covered in its purple pall with his royal coat of arms. It's rather finely set up, actually.
You said he sort of stayed at home and governed the country while his big brother was away. Because he was, I think there were four sons.
Henry IV's sons, yeah, yes.
That's right. But he also was involved in some fighting. He was perfectly capable of being a general or a commander himself, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. As a young man, he was certainly a brave soldier. He fought at Agincourt alongside his brother. Yes, he had a military career. He was a scholar. His collection of books is said to be the basis of the Bodleian Library in Oxford. There's still a chained library there called Duke Humphrey's Library. So he was quite an all-rounder, really, a person interested in poetry, music, scholarship, fighting, maybe too early to use the label, but a Renaissance man, early Renaissance, really.
And yet he came to a bit of a sticky end, didn't he?
Well, he did. You see, after Henry's death, of course, there's this infant, Henry VI, and the infant has his mum and several other people who really want to kind of rule in his name. And Humphrey's a bit of a challenge to that, because Humphrey has already been de facto ruler. So Humphrey's invited off in 1447. He's invited to go and meet the court and others at Bury St. Edmunds, at another great abbey, which now is in ruins. And he dies there very suddenly. They go to find him in his lodgings, and he's dead in the morning. No sign that he was particularly ill beforehand. And the big speculation has always been, was he murdered? Was he poisoned? It would have been a very easy way for the Queen to remove him from the scene and let her infant son rule. So perhaps that happened. They put his body on display to show that there were no sword marks or knife marks. You know, in other words, there was no sign of treachery to the body. But of course, poison doesn't show.
That's right. Although he was at Bury St. Edmunds then, was it his choice to be buried at St. Alban?
Oh yes, he'd always intended that. So his burial place, his chapel, his tomb was already there waiting for him. He knew he would die at some point, of course, so it was all prepared and ready. It took about a week or so for his procession to wend its way through England, and then it was received at St. Alban's Abbey by the abbot. The mass was said for his soul, and then he was sealed up in 1447. His tomb was sealed up and actually was forgotten about after the Reformation. People didn't even know it was there.
Okay, so you picked a couple of important names from the middle period. My guess is that as we move into the 19th century, there are some more villains and interesting parties.
Oh, there are so many. How do we choose who to talk about? One of the ones I love. Let's take a hero and a villain, shall we? Post-Reformation, the lovely man that we sometimes call Hylocomius, John Thomas Hylocomius. He was a schoolteacher. If you translate his memorial, and it's a lovely memorial. It's a painted one, not an engraved one. And it shows his skeleton lying at the bottom with a big grin on it. The skeleton is grinning. And in fact, when I show teachers around the abbey, I often say this is the happiest teacher I've ever seen. It's a dead one. I used to be a teacher. I'm allowed to make that joke. But the lovely translation, one of the lines that his pupil wrote was, "Nobody left his presence uncheered." What a nice man he must have been. You know, I think people genuinely liked good old Hylocomius. Nobody left his presence uncheered. So he's one of my heroes. And when I talk about training our guides and our stewards and our sidesmen, I often say, be like Hylocomius. No one should leave your presence uncheered.
The name is very strange. I mean, is that...
It is. It's a kind of Latinized version. He was probably John Thomas of... He's probably of Belgium. He was Belgian by origin, if you unpick it. So Hylocomius is probably the kind of Latinization of another name.
A Flemish name.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
So he was probably a refugee, a religious refugee.
Possibly. Although in that era, people did travel across Europe much more freely, of course. Let's give you a couple of other epitaphs, because I do like them. There's one which I've often wondered if it was put up by a bitter mother-in-law. It's about a young man who dies quite young. He's 30 years old. He's called Thomas Shepherd. And I guess his parents may have put this up. I can't believe his wife did. Let me read it to you. So Thomas Shepherd died February 15th, 1766. Great was my grief. I could not rest. God called me hence. He thought it best. Unhappy marriage was my fate. I did repent when it was too late. I just love the idea that his mum put that there as a kind of little jab at the wife.
Who was probably spitting in the eye of the Nora.
And there's another one from just a little bit later, about 20 years later, which is from a chap called William George King. And it's lovely because it's one of those ones that reminds you that as you walk around in this life, don't forget to prepare for the next life. Very kind of, religious sentiment. So this is William George King, who died in 1784. Once I, like you, could walk and view the tombs of friends interred, so you, like me, ere long must be. Go hence and be prepared. A little warning to those of us who linger in this world.
And that fellow who warned us was, in fact, he was a gentleman. He left some money, didn't he, or something?
Oh, yes, there are lots of charities, which now are all formed into one charitable. But he particularly left money for the rector to purchase bread to distribute to the poor on what they called Sacrament Sundays. In the 18th century, you only celebrated Holy Communion once a month. It wasn't a Sunday-by-Sunday activity. So on the 12 Sacrament Sundays of the year, and I love it. His will says, the industrious poor can be given bread. Doesn't that ring of some of the things we've heard lately? The industrious poor can be given bread.
None of those scroungers.
No, exactly.
Who else have we got?
Well, I do love, I sometimes, this is a bit fanciful on my part, but I sometimes show visitors the memorial to what I call is the grandmother of the three little bears. Frederica and Cecil Muir, M-U-R-E, Muir, lived in Abbots Langley, had a very fine house there. One of their daughters, Eleanor, who was a spinster all her life, wrote the very first version of The Three Little Bears. Uh-huh. And she wrote it for her nephew. One of her sisters had married now a little boy. It's reckoned as the first version of the story. But, in that first version, it's not as all lovely as it is in the one we know. There's no Goldilocks. She's invented much later, the young woman. It's an old woman. And the old woman eats the bear's porridge, indeed. And then the bears start to punish her, and they try and whip her and beat her, and in the end, they impale her on the spike of St. Paul's Cathedral. Not a nice story. I don't think we'd want to tell that one to our children these days.
And presumably rewritten several times, isn't it?
Yes, it's the first traceable version of the story we can find, or at least written down. It was probably a folk tale, but Eleanor Muir writes it down, and then later on, others turn into a much nicer story.
I speak to you.
Can I just mention, people don't know that St. Albans was the site of one of Britain's first real bank frauds. There was a savings bank, a Hertfordshire savings bank, in the early 1800s, and the rector of St. Albans, Henry Small, was in charge of this savings bank, and basically he absconded with the money. He ran off with the money. Now, Henry's got some relatives buried in the cathedral, because there's a tomb with just the one word, Small, written on it, which may or may not be a reflection on his memory. I don't know. He's probably not buried there himself, but he really was a scandalous rector. I mean, he absconded with church money. He absconded with the money of the savings bank. He was very colourful. I mean, somebody subsequently, here's some notes that somebody wrote down. John Harris wrote this in the late 1800s. He was a St. Albans citizen. He kept his horse in the Slipe. That was one of the buildings adjacent to the cathedral. And up to 1870, the iron hay rack still remained there to feed the horse. I've seen it scores of times. And then it gets more scandalous. He kept a concubine as well as a wife. He was treasurer of the savings bank. He embezzled money and bolted. Subscriptions were got up for the poor people. My father subscribed in 1835. So there's a St. Albans resident remembering this scandalous Henry Small. I have to say he was replaced by a very good rector, Nicholson, who was a very fine man and did a lot to recover, let's say, the reputation of St. Albans Abbey. In those days, the rectors were appointed by St. Albans, the mayor and the council. They appointed rectors, you see. And so probably he had, kind of the backing of members of St. Albans Council. So this St. Albans Savings Bank, or the branch of the Savings Bank, he probably was maybe in that with other politicians. Who knows where the money really went? The first dean, Walter Lawrence, and the first bishop, Thomas Claughton, are both buried in the churchyard, and they have their memorials in the building. They were very interesting characters. I mean, Lawrence was a great gentleman, and, was very kind and well-respected by the people in St. Albans. St. Albans was made a cathedral in 1877, but no money was ever provided for that. So poor old Lawrence tried to run a cathedral establishment on no budget whatsoever. Claughton, the first bishop, interesting man, again, kindly. He rather championed Lord Grimthorpe, who we'll talk about another time. But Claughton allowed himself to be swayed by the bully Grimthorpe. Lawrence was more prepared to stand up to him. Claughton's memorial in the cathedral, if you go and look in the north transept, I encourage any listeners to do that. There's a beautiful full-size effigy of Claughton lying there in state. It's an empty tomb in the sense that, because he's buried in the churchyard. And it was the occasion of a real put down by the previous dean. We were talking about the tomb, and we were talking about whether we might move it towards the wall and create some space. And I said, Mr. Dean, we could move it, because after all, he's not inside. He looked at me and said, "No, Stephen, he's in heaven." I felt truly put down by a clergyman. The nave of the building was used as a burial ground from the Reformation, from the 1530s, right up until probably the early 1800s. I guess the more perhaps connected you were, the more likely it was you could be buried inside the building. But round about the middle of the 1800s, even the building is full. And so burials start to take place outside the building in the north churchyard. And in fact, if you wander there, there are some excellent memorials you can look. And in fact, that churchyard was closed to burials. We bury ashes there. If you're a parishioner today, you can have your ashes buried there. We have actually opened it twice recently. You talk about opening a churchyard when you put a body in. We opened it for two of our recent bishops, Lord Runcie and Lady Runcie are both buried there. And most recently, we opened it for Bishop John Taylor, who died. So we make occasional exceptions to that, but usually it's ashes burials now.
So, I mean, it's not a very big graveyard, is it?
No, it isn't. It's a small area. It's packed, as all the areas are around the cathedral. If you dig a bit, you will come across burials, and you have to treat them reverently and reverently rebury them.
Yes. Okay, we're talking about treating reverently. We'll come to Lord Grimthorpe next time, because there's big arguments as to how reverent he was towards the building.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you.